on board.
All right, I think we might as well start.
Yeah.
My name's Kay Fang, I'm the moderator of this session on human rights and public responsibility. You don't see exactly the panel that is billed in your program, because Sierra Lewis and Sam Tito were not able to be with us today, and filling in for both, contending for both of them at the last minute is Lee Gorsuch, and my far as left. We both Sam Tito and Sierra Lewis. He's had all of about a half an hour's notice that he should be on the panel at all. Just a word about the format we're going to use. We want to be very informal. We want to involve all of you just as much as ourselves in this discussion. The category of human rights and public responsibility sounds to me a little bit like a catch-all. I think that maybe the things that don't fit into other categories perhaps fit into ours, so we will try to keep at least some relevance to the state constitution, and if we get too far afield, I'll try to bring it back. Let me just introduce the panel, and then we're going to take off with it in a very informal way for only 45 minutes or so, and after that open it up and let you all jump in and participate. As I said, on my far left is Edward Lee Gorsuch, who is the present director of the Institute of Social and Economic Research here at the University of Alaska. Before that, he was a senior associate of Robert Nathan, associate in an international consulting, economic consulting firm. And before that, he was with the Alaska Native Foundation. Next is Lisa Rudd, who is presently in the state legislature and is running for re-election. I have a copy of her campaign brochure here, so I regularly it. Lisa Rudd has got what it takes. It also says that she is a wife and mother with two teenage daughters. She's been one of Anchorage residents since 1959, and she's been a resident of Anchorage for more than 10 years. She holds a BA degree from Benson College in American History and Government and a master's degree in Public Administration from the University of Alaska. Before the Alaska legislature, she was on the Anchorage Charter Commission, Anchorage Employee Relations Board, Human Rights Commission, Alaska Festival of Music, and involved in the school. I'm sure most of you know this by reputation. And then next comes Dorothy Collins, who is our member of the original Alaska Constitutional Convention. Dorothy was born in Minnesota, and she's a graduate of Iowa College of Law with a Juris Doctor degree in 1946. She came to Alaska in 1945 as a U.S. Commissioner and City Magistrate in Cordova. She was the first law records clerk in the territory when appointed by Judge Diamond, and then went into private practice of law. And she's a delegate to the Constitutional Convention and a member of the 1957 legislature. She was Assistant Attorney General for 16 years and retired in May 1976. In June 1976, she was elected president of the U.S. section of St. John's International Alliance. She is the one that's going to be talking to us about what really did happen 20 years ago at the Constitutional Convention. I don't think that Ab Gross, sitting on my left, really needs any introduction. He's currently Attorney General for the state of Alaska, from New York City, and received his BA in 1957 from Anchorage College. He was in the private practice of the law from 1963 to 64 in Juneau, and became a partner. He's been active in the Alaska Bar Association and a member of the Board of Governors and Bar Association. He's also served as chairman and member of the Criminal Rules Division Committee of the Alaska Supreme Court. And as you all know, he's now Attorney General, and I'm sure and have a lot of interest. In fact, everyone on this panel has a great deal of interest to talk about. I'm going to start it out now with Dorothy, if you could give us a little background on how this all started 20 years ago.
It was suggested by a group to perhaps speak briefly on how the how we went about drawing up the Constitution. Some of you in the audience, I know, are very well aware of how we went about it. And I don't want to bore you, but I think some may not be acquainted with it. So I'll speak briefly to this. Constitutional Convention, you know, 55 delegates. And we were appointed to committees. And generally speaking, each committee was responsible for drawing up one article. The Constitution was divided up into 15 articles. I was, and this workshop mostly concerns the two articles, Declaration of Rights and the Health, Welfare, and Education Committee. And I was probably chosen for this panel because I was chairman of these two committees. Also involved maybe the article on the initiative referendum and recall committee, which I did not serve on, but of course I've become familiar with. Each committee would work on a draft of a proposed article. When the article was prepared, then we'd bring it out before the convention and make the suggestions, corrections, and amendments. And believe me, the body did this seriously, word by word, paragraph by paragraph. Everything that came out to me was checked, revised, amended if necessary. Then after this was done, it went to the Committee on Style and Drafting. And the Committee on Style and Drafting made necessary changes so that it was literarily correct and so that the style of the Constitution would be consistent and wouldn't do a complete change of style from one article to another. After Style and Drafting had done its work, it again came out before the entire convention so that we could make sure that the meaning hadn't been changed along with any words. Only after this was it adopted as a permanent part of the Constitution. The committee, I suppose, all had their own ways of working, the way our particular team worked. We all expressed our own ideas. And we also invited any other member of the convention who had expressed an idea by proposed provision or otherwise, something he thought should be in our article, to appear with our committee and accept with intelligent ideas and reasons. The committee, I think the Bill of Rights Committee probably, or Declaration of Rights, we call it, probably was successful as any committee in getting things worked out in committee. And there were a few things that were very controversial that we got to explore. But not really all that many, considering. Another thing as to how we proceeded, we had before is the Federal Bill of Rights, which is the first 10 amendments of the U.S. Constitution. I think it was fair to say that we use that generally as an outline. And we also have the provision that would be relevant to a number of state constitutions. And we consider those all, of course, in the light of whether or not they were relevant and necessary to Alaska. There were two things I think that were the principal consideration when we considered and stated a provision either in committee or on the floor of the convention. And one, what do we want, and is that what we're saying? And the second thing is this something that belongs in the Constitution, or should it better be left to the legislature as the statement? And I think you have to become familiar with a number of constitutions before you realize how very important this is. Because some states have all kinds of provisions in their constitution that don't belong there at all. And this means either the provisions stay in the constitution and the state gets defined in its social progress and reform, or else they're continually reforming the constitution. And we wanted to avoid it, so we never failed to consider. Now, is this something that really belongs in the Constitution? It can be
better than licensing.
If I may express a personal opinion, I think this is a company that is pretty successful on. There have been a few amendments, but really not all landmarks. The Declaration of Rights article means most of those provisions that you would expect to find in a Bill of Rights, such as having discrimination and freedom of religion, freedom of speech, the right to a grand jury, the right to assemble and petition, the prohibition of excessive punishment, the right of meeting in court, the prohibition of unlawful service, and so forth, so forth. I thought it might be of interest if I mentioned some of the most controversial items that came up in the convention concerning this article. Some of them became a part of the Constitution, some of them did not. One of the things that came up, somebody said we're guaranteeing freedom of religion, peace, rights, and so on and so forth. We ought to guarantee economic rights. Well, we got into quite a hassle on this because nobody could really define what economic rights were. And then somebody said that economic rights include the right to work. And you kind of put a right to work provision in the Constitution. And that was immediately countered by somebody saying we don't want a right to work provision, we'd rather have a right to collective bargain. And I think that was one of the most controversial things that we discussed with him. Article 1. We finally decided, and I think rightly so, that economic rights are too vague and indefinite, that rights to work and rights to collective bargaining and more property left to the legislature, so we left the whole thing out. And incidentally, even though the debate was very hot and heavy for a while on that, when we finally reached the final vote, the vote was weighted by a very large majority. As I recall, it was one half a dozen voting the other way. Another thing that was argued quite a bit, but I think more on details than on the general idea, was what place the grand jury had in our new state government. Some were felt very strongly that we should preserve the right of independence in a felony case to be indicted by a grand jury. Some thought that it should not be necessary. And also there was a question whether or not the grand jury should retain the right to investigate public matters. Finally, which took what might be called a more conservative view, and preserved the right or power of the grand jury in the territory of an independent and criminal case, the felony state has the right to be indicted by a grand jury, and also that the grand jury has the right to investigate matters in welfare. We didn't see the size of the grand jury from not less than 12 to not less than 23, and we retained the provision that it takes a majority to indict rather than three-fourths or some other percentage. The reason that came up was some people said, well, if we're going to have 12 instead of 22 grand jurors, then it ought to take more to indict. And then there was quite a bit of argument that the three-fourths in the same traditional majority necessary. We also debated, not as long and hard, I think, the right to a jury of 12 people. Some thought that jury of 6 could be authorized by the legislature. And now I'm talking only about criminal cases. We finally put a provision in that the right to a jury of 12 people was preserved in the courts of record, but that the legislature could provide for a jury of 6 in criminal cases and court of law of record, which is the district court saying, I think this is the court saying, I think there's a new one. The one thing that I think we really caused most debate, and drawing up the declaration of rights, was the question of whether we should have a provision in the Constitution prohibiting wiretapping. This was one issue that we debated at great length in the committee. And we finally, by a majority vote, voted that it should not be in the Constitution. But there were, I think, 3 out of 7 members felt strongly enough to vote a minority report saying it should be in. And that is the only issue that I can remember that our committee was divided enough on that we had felt that that vote was good and minority report in opposition. Well, we went from wiretapping to all electronic devices. And then somebody said, well, why all electronic devices? Why not all scientific devices? And then somebody said, well, then you're going to outlaw fingerprinting for many years. And I think that one interesting comment, E.B. Collins, a lawyer here in Fairbanks, is our oldest delegate, too. And he got up and he said, now just think, someday we might not have enough traffic in Alaska that the police will want to use radar. Now I just would almost bypass radar and have new scientists. Curious, give an idea how far we've come in 20 years. Anyhow, we really debated that for days. And we finally got so hung up on these problems that we decided the whole thing should be better left. Legislation other than the traditional provision that we couldn't search properly. Incidentally, in that connection, one of the few amendments of the Constitution was in 1972 when they amended the Declaration of Rights by putting in the right of privacy. And I think that that is. Well, in fact, this is when we were arguing that sometimes it's virtually the right of privacy for them to go get some wiretapping because it's invading the right of privacy. So we're really discussing the right of privacy amendment for the time or provision when it came up by amendment in 1972. It's a very short amendment and provides merely that the right of privacy is recognized and shall not be infringed and that it should be left to the legislature. So, there's some question whether the court can be so held even without an amendment. Another thing that was discussed for a while was whether or not we should prohibit making a defendant in a criminal case pay his own cost. Now, those of you who are familiar with the law in territorial age, then we had a system of federal courts. And the federal court held that, I suppose they still do, the court could, if it was reasonable, and it took the defendant to have to pay costs. And it's quite a strong argument we shouldn't allow that to be done. And at the time, it was also abused, that it should be left out. And you should leave it the way it was. It was territorial statutes at that time. Under territorial law, you could do it, but it didn't make any sense whether we had any statutes like that. Or not because the law that we're operating in was already stated. One other thing, and then I'll have somebody else talk along. Lisa on my left asked me how Section 3 happened to get into the Declaration of Rights, and that's the provision that says no person shall be denied enjoyment of any civil or political rights because of race, color, creed, or national origin. And 20 years ago, I don't think there were many constitutional provisions like that. I think we were ahead of the times. And whether we would have thought of it on our own, I don't know or not. But somebody pointed out that there was an Abling Act in the Eastern Congress. We know the state was built in the Eastern Congress in 1912 on the gestation. This particular one about that time was called House Bill 2535. And it requires that if states would be given Alaska Constitution, they have to provide for no discrimination on the basis of race or color. And we discussed that, and then we went on and added increase our national origin. We also discussed whether we should suspect when it was voted down, not because people at the convention didn't want such equality, but a number, at least, were naive enough to think that Alaska would not discriminate on basis of being adopted in the Constitution. But we were naive on that score, and that was another amendment, the only other amendment that I know of the Declaration of Rights. And it was added by inserting the words sex to that section in 1972, which is still part of the working. So,
in fact, that's a wonderful roundup, though, that for us to kick off from, Dorothy. I know that Lisa has done a good deal of work with that. Last time you discussed the discrimination plan, and maybe she'd like to kick off with that.
I'll talk a little bit about Section 3, the one that Dorothy just read. No person is to be denied the enjoyment of any civil or political right because of race, color, creed, sex, or national origin. The legislature shall implement this section. I was interested recently in reading this section, the Declaration of Rights section, to find that this was the only section of the Declaration of Rights section which carried a mandate to the legislature to implement the section. And that interested me because, as Dorothy said, I had asked her how it came to be that section was in our Constitution, because that was in 1956, and there was not at that time the tremendous push for civil rights that developed just a few years later, although the Brown versus Board of Education decision on school desegregation was in 1954, and the impetus was beginning to grow. I was very interested in learning why that section got into our Constitution. I, having worked in the field of human rights for many years, I'm very prejudiced about this section, but I think it has provided us in the state of Alaska with a framework for a commitment to equal opportunity for all of our people over these past 20 years that cannot be matched by any other state in the Union. And it has provided us with not only the commitment, but the method for dealing with cases of discrimination that come to our attention, and with a method for studying areas of where we may need to do more work in the area of discrimination. And if it had not been for that section in the Constitution, we may not, for instance, have had the ability to support the land claims movement to the extent that it was supported by people who cared about those things in the late 1960s. We may not. I know that the Human Rights Commission was very involved in that support movement. We may not have had the ability to provide the personnel to Senator Bartlett when he was interested in guaranteeing the civil rights to the people of the Pribilof Islands, who at the time of statehood were virtually serfs of the federal government. This section, to my mind, provided us with a commitment and a framework which has been of tremendous benefit to the state over the 20 years. I might talk just a bit about how the legislature has implemented this section. It wasn't until 1963, 4 years after statehood, that the legislature passed the first comprehensive laws against discrimination to implement the civil rights section on the Declaration of Rights. And those laws basically guarantee the right to employment and to housing and to education and to public accommodation, regardless of race, creed, color, national origin. At that time, no, sex was not included at that time. What it did also was to set up a human rights commission which had the power to receive complaints of discrimination, to make investigation of those complaints, to make findings on those investigations, and to enforce orders emanating from those findings. It was possible for the Human Rights Commission, upon receiving a complaint of discrimination, to order the person who had done the discriminating to, for instance, give back pay to an employee who either had not been hired because of race or color or creed, or to reinstate an employee with that pay who had been fired for reason of race, and so on. It gave teeth to this general statement of policy, which is in the Constitution. The general statement of policy in the Constitution did not at the time of the writing of the Constitution, and I would say it should not have either, but it did not have the enforcement mechanism that really is necessary in order to guarantee that people are going to be able to achieve their rights. And what the 1963 legislation did was to set up a Human Rights Commission with the power to receive complaints and enforce the orders resulting from their investigation of those complaints. In 1969, the laws setting up the Human Rights Commission were amended to add to the section that gives the commission the power to study areas of discrimination. And that's a very important power of the commission also, not only to receive and investigate complaints, but to study areas of discrimination and to foster goodwill in the community. This is a very broad power of the commission, which allows the commission to step into a situation which may be brewing and take a hand in keeping things going right. In that section, in 1969, sex was added to the list of race, creed, color, national origin, and so on, so the commission was now empowered to study discrimination on the basis of sex. In 1972, and that was the year that the federal Equal Rights Amendment passed the Congress, and Alaska was the second state to ratify the Equal Rights Amendment, which guarantees that persons shall not be abridged their rights on the basis of sex. At the same time that Alaska ratified the federal Equal Rights Amendment to the United States Constitution, we also added sex to the Civil Rights section right in the Constitution, in the Declaration of Rights, so that it read, no person is to be denied the enjoyment of any civil or political right because of race, color, creed, sex, or national origin. That was added in 1972 at the same time that we ratified the Federal Equal Rights Amendment. I was interested in reading in Vic Fisher's book that there had been a proposal to add sex at the time that the Constitution was written, and I was rather pleased to see that. The latest amendment to the law is in the 1975 session of the legislature, the categories of prohibited discrimination were added, these categories were added, marital status, changes in marital status, pregnancy, and parenthood. In other words, it is against the law to discriminate against someone in housing, employment, education, public accommodation.
That was added to this section?
No, not to the Constitution, but to the law, which implements the Constitution. It is now illegal to discriminate against a person in those areas of employment and education, public accommodation, and housing, on the basis of those factors. I'd like to mention just briefly the kinds of things that the Human Rights Commission has done aside from investigative points. The Human Rights Commission has over the years studied a number of areas of discrimination and been fairly instrumental in bringing areas to public attention and helping to solve the problem of discrimination. I mentioned the Native Land Claims movement. I think that if it had not been for the Human Rights Commission, in fact, the Human Rights Commission at the time of the foundation of the Federation of Natives in 1966 provided backup for that first AFN conference that has provided a lot of time and staff money, staff and time and money, all of it, to that convention. That convention might not have taken place. Also, over the years, the Belt School in Nome provided some interesting questions to the commission about whether or not segregated education was right for the eczema students in that area, whether it was working well, whether they were getting the kind of education they deserved, and whether or not the dormitory situation up there was within the realm of something that the Human Rights Commission should be interested in. I mentioned the Krivoloff study. At the present, the Human Rights Commission is engaged in a study of the status of women in Alaska. And this report will be given to the next legislature for possible further implementation.
You want, let me see, yeah. It's interesting that you talked, really brought us up to date from where we started 20 years ago, kind of through what's happened now. Earlier when we were talking, you mentioned that this Section 3 also gave rise to the whole Native Land Claims movement. Would you just like to get into that a little bit?
I can't say that it gave rise to the Native Land Claims movement, but as I said, I think it set the climate and made it possible. The Human Rights Commission, as I said, provided time and staff and money for the first statewide Native conference that took place in 1966. And I think that the fact that this section was in our Constitution made us recognize that we could not turn our back on the rights of the Native people to retain their land and to enjoy living on it.
We're going to open this to all of you very, very shortly. Could we just finish some of the thoughts that the panel had here, and then we're going to throw it open, okay? Ab, you have several areas that you were going to get into here. Why don't you just pick up the ball and run with it, then we'll throw it open and come back to many of these 10 areas.
Well, I thought I'd review very briefly some of the problems that have come up under the human rights area and what's happened with the Constitution since it was written. The human rights article, like the Bill of Rights, is a little different than any other portion of the Constitution. The rest of the Constitution states the government powers, how the government works, gives power to the executive branch, legislative, and such. The human rights article is basically a statement of what government can't do. It's a statement of what rights are retained to the people and how they may not be infringed by the government. And as a result, the human rights article, more than any other article, is probably just as meaningful as the courts that interpret it are, because that's where the disputes end up. Disputes between individuals and their governments normally end up in courts. And we've had, I think we'd all agree, very active Supreme Court. In some instances, it's been a broken, what some people have termed new ground in the field of human rights, interpreting the Constitution. Some people feel that it's gone too fast, I think, that it's made too broad interpretations. I don't agree with that. I don't think you can ever strengthen individual rights too quickly, particularly in a society which, because of how many more of us there are and how we have to live together in the same area, there are more and more rules to control us so we don't keep stepping on each other's toes, and one of the inevitable consequences of that is that the individual freedom tends to give way to mass rules for the mass society. So I think any time a court comes out with a decision which strengthens individual rights vis-a-vis the government, it's probably healthy for us in the long run. But let me just review briefly some of the areas of the Constitution and where they've gone today. 5, 6, and 7 of the Bill of the Human Rights section all really talk about the same basic kind of thing. Section 5 is the right of people to speak, write, or publish, being responsible for an abuse of that right. That conforms, that same right, of course, is preserved in the First Amendment of the United States Constitution. Section 6 talks about the right of people to peaceably assemble and petition their government. And Section 7 talks about due process and the right of citizens to fair and just treatment in the course of legislative and executive investigation. But this article was written during the 1950s. And in the 1950s, we were going through a period in this country where Congress and I think civil rights, individual rights, were coming under rather severe attack, primarily under a fear of subversion, communism. There were congressional investigations going on. You remember McCarthy and the House Un-American Activities Committee. And there were a number of court decisions which I think jeopardized the civil rights. So when this constitutional convention met, it stressed, I think, the reaffirmation of the rights of an individual to engage in a political process free of unreasonable government interference. And particularly in the courts, they specifically mentioned in congressional or legislative and executive investigation. Now, right after that, that whole era sort of ended. It was sort of interesting. The committees, which were having witnesses appear before them regularly, sort of stated. And that article of our Constitution, interestingly enough, has never been called into play. What has happened is that the rights of association, the rights to gather together for political purposes, which is specifically affirmed in Section 6, the right to assemble and petition the government, which is, under the U.S. Supreme Court, has been interpreted to mean the right to associate with others for political purposes, free of government interference, has shifted. We've got a different kind of problem now. The problem's arisen under public disclosure laws. Years ago, people were worried during the 50s when we were talking about the right of assembly. We were talking about situations, for instance, in Alabama, in some of the southern states, that were trying through legislative investigation to get hold of the membership list of organizations like the NAACP and other civil rights groups in the South. The Supreme Court came out with some rather clear decisions saying the right of association is a basic right, and the government can't interfere with it, and if getting membership lists would interfere with it, that means that you can't have those membership lists. Well, that law lasted, that's been part of our constitutional law until fairly recently, when Congress passed the Federal Campaign Disclosure Act and our state legislature adopted the public disclosure law, which requires candidates and groups backing candidates to disclose where they get their money and how they use their money. That's causing some interesting dilemmas in the state right now. We've just had an interesting example, for instance, of what happens when you deal with an organization like Common Sense, I think it was, that advocates a position rather than a candidate. Now, the U.S. Supreme Court has talked about this issue. Our state Supreme Court never has. But the U.S. Supreme Court has said that where you can require people to disclose if they're contributing to candidates, the government has an interest in making sure that the people who vote in elections know where a candidate gets his money. That's a different thing than saying that when groups band together to advocate an idea, just an idea, that the government has any right to require them to publish who their membership is. That's closer to the NAACP situation back in Alabama. So when you get into an organization like Common Sense or one thing or another, people, I think, tend to quickly say, well, they're a political group. Why don't they disclose who they are? But it's precisely because they are a political group in the larger sense, not candidates, but politics in the issue sense, that they don't have to disclose who they are. And our laws, I think, will be interpreted to say that. But as I said, we've shifted now. We've shifted from the rights of people to not disclosed. Now we're starting to emphasize the situations in which we do have to disclose. Dorothy mentioned the grand jury. That's in Article, I think in Article 7, or 8, I'm sorry. Now the grand jury debate still goes on. The Constitutional Convention considered whether or not a grand jury should be used for the purpose of indicting people for felonies. And the theory was that the grand jury stands between the people and an overzealous prosecutor who might otherwise simply harass people without having a grand jury be able to stop it. I think, in all honesty, that's a specious argument. Being on the prosecutorial side, let me tell you that in 99.9% of the cases, and perhaps closer to 100, a careful prosecutor can get a grand jury to do basically what he wishes them to do for the simple reason that he controls what evidence the grand jury hears. If he controls what evidence the grand jury hears, it's not surprising that the grand jury normally agrees with the prosecutor. And in later years, people have come to realize that we may be dealing with a sham here, and that that it sounds good, but in practice, it never really works. And as a result, they've been reconsidering whether or not the grand jury is truly effective in protecting the public against anyone. I'm not sure it is. And I think that realistically, we have to take a look at whether it really plays any role in our society anymore. The second function of the grand jury, that of investigation, is unfortunately often abused. You must remember that a grand jury, what a grand jury does is absolutely privileged, which means that if the grand jury chooses to investigate a public official or anything they feel like investigating, they can say anything they want about an individual, free of the standards of proof which exist in criminal courts or even civil courts, and free of any responsibility for what they say. For instance, if the grand jury decided to investigate the division of buildings and came up with a conclusion that so-and-so in the division of buildings was a crook and had been stealing money from the division of buildings, they could say that in a report, and it would be carried in newspapers around the state, and it might be absolutely false, and it might be totally unproved, and yet that individual would see his reputation destroyed, and there would be nothing he could do about it. There's no way he could sue the grand jury, there's no way he could affirm his innocence, and that's dangerous, there's no question about it. But then just about the time that everybody starts thinking, well, maybe this is so dangerous we better not have it, along comes Watergate, and a grand jury does what grand juries are supposed to do, which is to really dig and be a real investigative and careful tool. And they reaffirm people's belief in what they were all about in the first place. So I suppose we have to take the chance of some abuse, I suppose, in that area to preserve the citizens' right to investigate what really goes on in their own government.
We argued that it's constitutional convention, I think those are the identical arguments that were made by those who were What kind of alternative is there to add to a grand jury?
Well, right now the grand jury is the investigative arm of it's the only body to which you can compel people to testify. You can call them in and put them under oath and require them to tell you what they know or face possible contempt proceedings. You can't do that as a prosecutor and you can't do that as a policeman. People can simply refuse to talk to you.
So you're saying really there is no alternative?
There isn't a viable alternative which has been worked out. There have been instances in which grand juries have been truly valuable investigative tools of Watergate, that I can think of. But there's been also numerous instances of abuse. I suppose it's like all instances of government, if it's in the hands of the wrong people, it can do some bad things. And the real control on it isn't what's written down, it's who does it. Section 11 and 12 has to do with the rights of accused in criminal cases, and particularly reference bail. Now, it says that there's bail to be is an absolute right in this state, except for capital offenses, that's death penalty offenses, and we don't have any of those, so it's an absolute right for all crimes. Now, bail is probably the least understood of all our civil rights, and every once in a while, a misunderstanding rears its head in space. Some of you may remember fairly recently, there was an individual arrested in Anchorage for a particularly horrible sex crime involving a minor. And he was released on a fairly low bail. Now, the people of Anchorage, or many of them, became incensed. And many wrote the newspapers and cried publicly that it was the court's job to keep people in that like that, in jail, so they wouldn't jeopardize the public. But the problem with that was, of course, that the individual involved hadn't been proved to have done anything. And in fact, had never previously been convicted of anything like that. And under our system, bail is the necessary correlation of the principle that you're innocent until proven guilty. That means that until somebody proves you guilty, you are innocent. And the only function of bail is to make sure you show up when they try you. That's the only function of bail. It's not to punish people. So that if a court is convinced that bail, that the individual will show up, they have a right to be released. That's the test. And I think the case in Anchorage, in the Locke case it was in some ways a healthy experience for the community, not because it got people upset, certainly did that, but because at least it provoked some discussion as to what bail was supposed to be all about. And and people may not have agreed with it, but at least they debated it, discussed it, and thought about it a little bit, and that's how civil rights survive, I expect, in the long run. Section 12 also talks about penal administration, and the way our penal system is supposed to be structured for reformation and the need to protect the public. Incidentally, the executive article of the Constitution also contains a provision which requires that the legislature shall establish a parole system. So the Constitution does set up the basis of penal administration, but the problem is it doesn't say how much weight is to be given to each particular facet of it. I think everybody could agree that a penal system should be based on reformation and the need to protect the public. But what do you do if you don't know how to reform people? And what do you do if the public is screaming particularly hard to be protected? It's all a balance. And how you resolve that balance is a legislative question, I think, and the Constitution left it to the legislature, I think, to deal with those conflicting, often conflicting problems. And we're seeing that now in the kind of bills which are before the legislature involving new sentencing systems, like mandatory sentences, determinate sentences, fixed sentences for certain crimes. People say, well, that doesn't take account of reformation. And other people respond by saying, well, yes, it does. It's simply that it emphasizes the need to protect the public. So this debate goes on. Section 19, which talks about the militia is necessary to increase the security of a free state, therefore the people's right to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. I think a lot of people may mistakenly believe that this is a constitutional prohibition against gun control. It isn't. It's been interpreted by the United States Supreme Court not to be anyway. If there's not going to be gun control in the state, it's going to be because the legislature never permits it, or the Congress never permits it, but not because our Constitution prohibits it. And finally, I think the most important amendment of all, and the most important provision of our equal rights, or our Bill of Rights, is the one that didn't appear in the original Constitution, but now does, and that's probably the right of privacy. I think that in the long run, we're going to become a great deal more dependent on the right of privacy for our individual freedom than we are on any other section in that Bill of Rights. Because as the power of the state grows more sophisticated and more complicated, and as Dorothy says, as we go beyond radar into the era of electronic surveillance, which may or may not be searches, but certainly involve invasions of privacy, of invasions into your home, of systems to determine what citizens are doing when, of systems considered at the federal level of actually placing not bugs, but communication devices in people's homes, so that they can know what their government wants and their government can know what they're doing. These are kind of frightening. And the right of privacy, I think, reflects the citizen's concern about it. Now, the only time it's been implemented has been in the very emotional area, the right to smoke marijuana in your own home. And that touches all kinds of other emotions and buttons that people, I think, react to. But I think the basic right, which was affirmed in that case, the right of people to be left alone in their homes, unless the government can prove that it has a substantial interest in coming into your home, is going to be remembered long after we forget that marijuana was even involved in that case. I think someday, a lot of the people who felt very concerned about the fact that marijuana was made legal, and may bless the day that our Supreme Court affirmed firmly that there are points beyond which the state may not go, that it may not enter your home unless it can prove that it has a right to be there, and that there are times that you just have the right to be left alone. Now that's going to be a very important right in a society which is becoming as sophisticated and complicated as ours is now. And I think people did extremely good things by putting it in our Constitution.
How far ahead of other states are we on that, on the right to privacy? Is that becoming something that's being done in other states around the country?
Yes, there's been some judicial decisions from other states which have read a right of privacy into other provisions in the Constitution. I don't think any states have gone as far as they wanted to.